This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Okay, thank you, Ian. Do you want us to sit here?
It's entirely up to you.
Us sit here and make it more friendly. Okay. The whole of today's event is obviously based around the Queen's speech and what it has signalled, but I want to broaden it a little bit, really. Just start by briefly looking back at the general election, then the Queen's speech, and looking forward to the budget and what these three things signal, because I think the contrast between what went on during the general election and what we now see ahead of us is slightly different and in an interesting way. In many ways, what the Queen's speech signalled and what's happened subsequently a signal for public sector funding was during the election an issue that dare not speak its name. It was carefully disguised, if you remember, at the time during the general election by all the major parties by endless references to efficiency savings. Remember all of those. And efficiency savings generally for most parties, and then an attack on the other party for having false efficiency savings. So that's how it was handled during the general election. And also references to what the previous government called challenging times and other such gentle euphemisms for the world that we have now actually arrived in. And what's important about this, it seems to me, is that although we all knew in a sort of open secret way, partly because of the excellent work done by the Institute for Fiscal Studies and others who relentlessly kept us abreast of what the real picture was, the difficulty that we have now is that none of the parties that fought the general election really have a mandate for what they're about to do. Now, it's true they're trying to adjust the way we think about this very rapidly, and the Queen's speech was a part of that, but it will remain an issue that the electorate haven't quite given their assent for the scale of what is about to occur, and that could come back to haunt us, and I'll refer to that again in a moment or two. Now, we know what the big issue here is, and it's going to be, as Ian has suggested, of other things, a key element in what goes on for the whole of today. It's going to come back. And the key issue is the deficit. This extraordinarily large number of billions of pounds that the government is borrowing each year, equivalent to around 11% of GDP. And in fairness, of course, it's mostly generated not by a big increase in public expenditure, though we are still living this year in the last year of the old period of growth in terms of public expenditure. But the deficit is predominantly generated, or significantly generated, by the fall in tax revenues during the recession. Now, some of that will come back, of course. The tax revenues should return as when and if full economic growth returns, although that is itself now a questioned item because the Office for Budget Responsibility that's been set up is, it would appear, about to tell us that the Treasury's previous forecasts, 3.25% growth per year from next year onwards, are optimistic. And if they are optimistic, then the squeeze required to get the deficit down is even greater than was previously thought. Within this £156 billion, 11% of GDP-style annual deficit is a structural deficit, and that is probably half the total. That is the amount that wouldn't disappear when the tax yield returned. So this, you know, the mathematically rapid amongst us will work out, means that to some extent that around £50 to £70 billion worth of public expenditure or tax increases will have to be cut in public spending of that scale or increases in taxation, amounting in total to something of 50 to 70 billion to remove the rest of the deficit that isn't eroded by growth in the economy, assuming that growth occurs. Now, the present government appears set on a balance of reducing this deficit of sort of 80-20 spending cuts versus tax increases. So again, you can see we're talking here about spending reductions of £40 to £60 billion on an existing total of around £700 billion. So you can see that means in real terms reductions of public expenditure, which could in total be nearly 10% of the existing overall amount. Now, before the Queen's speech, and this still exists, we have the question which is posed by a number of commentators, economists particularly, which is whether it is right to reduce this deficit at the speed the government is proposing, which is actually not that different to the speed the previous government was proposing. Alistair Darling was proposing to reduce the deficit sharply by 2014-15. George Osborne appears committed to doing that and more, but there's nevertheless a commitment rapidly to reduce the deficit. Alistair Darling was relying more on growth than George Osborne is, but nevertheless, this is a very short term over which to reduce the deficit so much. Now, a number of commentators, not only on the left, believe that the deficit should be reduced much more slowly, i.e. using growth, assuming it returns, to bring the biggest reduction in the deficit, while others, but again not only on the right, see this approach as continuing to tax the future and that therefore we do need to bring the deficit down more rapidly. I think what the Queen's speech and the various financial statements that have been made, subsequently the sort of non-budgetary reduction of £6.25 billion of the public expenditure announced a couple of weeks ago, and the new document published by the Treasury this week, on Monday, Tuesday, what these clearly show is that the present government is committed, the coalition is committed, to what will be the sharpest public expenditure reductions probably since the 1940s. There's a very interesting paper to be accessed off the SOLAS, the Society of Local Authority Chief Executives, and CITFA, Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy's website, which has a fascinating chart in it, which looks at the growth in public expenditure by decade, certainly since the 1960s. What's revealing about that is that it shows even in the 1980s, Mrs. Thatcher's decade, public expenditure growth grew in real terms. In the most recent decade, the one we've just finished, public expenditure grew more rapidly in real terms than in any of the other decades since and including the 1960s. So what the present government is now suggesting is an actual fall in real terms, i.e. a sharper reduction in public expenditure than we saw even during Mrs. Thatcher's years. And if you consider the way in which people see Mrs. Thatcher and her approach to public expenditure, still visibly on display every day, really, in the media, it's going to be like that, but more so. So, I don't think we've all fully adjusted ourselves to the scale of what lies ahead. And, of course, if you add that to the fact that it will come after, so it'll be the slowest increase in public expenditure, actually, more likely, a real terms cut in public expenditure, following the decade where there was the biggest increase in public expenditure, any decade certainly since the 50s or probably the 50s, we are talking about a fifth gear to reverse kind of gear change, an extraordinary change, and that, I think, will create a bigger degree of political reaction than if it had come from a lower increase, from a period where there had been a lower increase. Now, this begs difficult questions. This is being broadcast, so one must be more careful than perhaps one would normally be.
No, please don't.
All right, thank you, Ian. I mean, it inevitably begs questions, and politicians have raised this, about the extent to which there will be a reaction, putting it gently. That is, will there be civil unrest? We can see from other countries that have made this adjustment, perhaps our near neighbours Ireland are the nearest to us in many, many ways, but beyond Ireland lie in the experience of countries such as Latvia, which are much more extreme, that there is bound to be some protest in the street, that is for sure, and Greece, of course. The only question is how far, and will it go, and how far will that put pressure on the government? Because the government's still in a honeymoon period, you can tell that. It won't be much of a honeymoon by the time the reality of these public expenditure cuts bites. And there will be regional differentiation in all of this. I don't want to steal John's thunder, but there's no doubt that if the overall reduction in public sector employment is of the scale that the CIPD and others have been talking about, it won't have an equal effect everywhere. In the local authority we're sitting in Westminster, public sector is a relatively small employer. But if you're in Middlesbrough or Blackpool, the public sector is a very large employer. And that means a similar reduction percentage terms across the country will have a very different effect on unemployment from place to place. Putting it crudely, a number of towns and cities that used to have industry as their main employer now have the public sector as their main employer, and that's about to become a declining industry itself. And so there are north-south type, though they're not all in the north, actually, and they're not all in the south, but there are geographical implications of this as well. Nearly finished. I think the government is going to be faced, we've heard a great deal in the last week about Canada. Canada is the model for, and the way the government set up the approach to reducing public expenditure has been borrowed, we're told, from Canada. There's a big difference, in my view, between Britain and Canada. In Canada, the federal government, and it is in a federal system, pushed a lot of the awkward decisions down to provincial government. Britain doesn't have provincial government. It only has local government, and local government isn't the same. And indeed, the willingness of any central government in Britain to push these decisions to local government, you have to wonder how far they will ever be prepared to do that. Because British central governments don't trust British local governments. Whatever they say about localism, they always have difficulty in doing this. So I think central government is going to be faced with a very stark choice, because it's decided to ring-fence some areas of public expenditure, the NHS in particular. That's going to mean very deep reductions in other programmes, capital most obviously, but also things that the public treasures deeply, like libraries or the fire brigade. Nobody mentions preserving them. And I think the government will be forced, myself, into pulling back from protecting some areas and not protecting others, because it will be easier for the government to go for salami slicing. It will be politically easier to make across-the-board reductions, particularly if public sector pay can take some of the strain, than trying to preserve spending in some areas and make very, very deep cuts in others. And that's just a kind of personal observation. We'll see whether I'm right or not. My final thought is that we are going to be faced as a society, and this is something, whether George Osborne wants us to or not, we're all going to debate, how big the state should be and what kind of state that should, what kind of state it is. This came up at the end of the previous session, I know, that, you know, the whole debate about the big society, which is a bit amorphous, I think contains within it the seeds of a bigger discussion about how big we want the state and what we want the state to do and which institutions we want to provide things the state now delivers. And that could require a very radical change. And normally you'd say, well, all governments say they want to change things radically. The big difference now is that the scale in the reduction of public expenditure will create the political impetus, potentially at least, for change, radical alterations to the way things work that would not otherwise have been the case. It's simply an unavoidable, it's rather like an external intervention, like something the government's trying to avoid, like an IMF visit, that gives governments the power to make changes they can't make otherwise.
Great, thank you very much, Tony. John, if you want to...
No, actually, I'll sit here as well. I'm just thinking, we've been told that we've waved goodbye to sofa government, so perhaps I'm redressing the balance by having sort of sofa conference thing. This must be the most miserable subject going at the moment, but, you know, there's no way that we can avoid it. It's probably best to get it out of the way at the start of an event like this. I'd say, I mean, most people, when they give, you know, talks and presentations, tend to quote some grand philosopher or guru, but, you know, my favourite sort of benchmark is Victor Meldrew of One Foot in the... grave fame, who in one episode was sitting sort of pondering the whys and wherefores of life and said to his wife, just when it seems as though things are never going to get any better, they get worse. And that's sort of slightly how I see the economic situation at the moment. We are facing quite a tough period, probably tougher than most people anticipate. Tony's neatly sort of kind of teed me up in a way, so I don't need to go over any really of that ground before. But I thought I might pick up, just as prefacing what I primarily want to say, this issue about the debate about the size of the state, the role of government in society. Because I think what's quite interesting is that, there are, apart from sort of questions of timing, which are, important to some extent, apart from those, I don't think there's any disagreement that there is a need for the structural deficit to be, at least halved. I don't think there's any sort of political dispute about that. What's been interesting in the month since the coalition was formed is that there's been a deliberate attempt to try and confine the policy narrative on the deficit reduction into a fairly sort of simple and single format, which is essentially that it's got to be mostly about cuts in public spending and very little on the tax side. Tony mentioned the now famous 80-20 split, which means really that as well as having a kind of technical economic debate about how we reduce the deficit, that there is an underlying strategic political objective to substantially reduce the share of public spending in national income and just more generally reduce the role of the state in the economy and social activity. Now, whether one agrees with that or not is beyond the confines of this particular session. But in a sense, although the government is prepared to consult on the issue of how we go about cutting spending, the sort of broader question, I think, is seen as kind of taken as read. And, any sort of kind of dispute or dissent about that is seen as, in some sense, kind of economically illiterate or out of bounds. Now, I don't want to get into that discussion because it's not my place to. Suffice to say that if you do take the position that you put most of the onus on spending cuts, that has its own particular implications for the way that deficit reduction is going to impact on individuals, groups and various communities. And as Tony said, we know from all previous experience that, in these circumstances, it, whatever people say about all in it together, sharing, et cetera, it always tends to be the people at the bottom who suffer most. And how we protect those as we go forward, will be a key policy issue and political issue, no doubt. What I want to primarily concentrate in my sort of remaining 10 minutes or so is really what this coming age of austerity will mean for jobs, not just in the public sector, but more widely in terms of the overall impact on the labour market and unemployment. Now, again, as has been mentioned, it's been clear over recent weeks that we're kind of all Canadians now, and the deficit reduction measure owes a lot to the Canadian experience. If you actually look back at what happened in the 90s when the Liberal government started to introduce its deficit reduction policy, what was significant was that it focused almost exclusively on spending cuts. There was almost no emphasis at all on taxes, possibly even more aggressively than we're going to see in this country. And over the period of deficit reduction, which was a kind of bulk of the 90s, they cut in the order of 260 or so thousand from the public sector workforce, which at the time was around 3 million. So that's kind of in general, it's sort of pretty close to what would be expected in this country. And indeed, if you translate that figure into to UK terms. You get a number which is pretty similar to one that CIPD was thinking about prior to the election, looking at what was then expected in terms of likely spending cuts and what was also being said by managers who were waiting for this surge to hit them on the ground. That was the half a million figure that we came up with before the election was actually a sort of baseline, and it's pretty clear to us that the new coalition government is actually going to be much more aggressive than might have been the case, for example, if Labour had been re-elected, or indeed if there'd been another form of coalition. And so over a period of the next 4 to 5 years, we're expecting public sector employment overall to drop by around 725,000. Now, that's a forecast. All forecasts are subject to the possibility that the world will turn out differently, but I think that's the kind of scale of magnitude that that one needs to be looking at. And I don't really see any great way that you can sort of manage this process that would, kind of reduce the overall scale. You know, people talk about reductions in hours or pay restraint akin to what we saw in the private sector during the recession. But the two situations are completely non-comparable. What we're looking at for the public sector over the next few years is substantial and profound downsizing, structural change. Those jobs, unless there's a political change of will, those jobs won't come back. So one has to assume that they're gone for forever. Now, if you have job losses on that scale, they don't necessarily mean that you're going to get a mass rise in unemployment. When Canada had its 1990s deficit reduction, unemployment actually fell over the period. Similarly, in the 90s, when the UK public sector dropped around 800,000 jobs, actually employment overall increased and unemployment fell. And the main reason for that was that we had a growing economy that was generating lots of private sector jobs. The difficulty that we've got this time round is that we've been we're at the backstage of a kind of record depression, effectively. We call it a recession, but we have actually, the global economy has been through a kind of mini recession, and we've had our own version of it. And the deficit, the structural deficit, is really a kind of delayed facet of that, which means that we're going to have a kind of delayed impact on the jobs market of the recession that we've already seen, essentially whether we like it or not. I think if you change the balance of policy deficit reduction between spending and taxation, you would probably alleviate the worst excesses of the pain of this for those who are most disadvantaged, and make it a more fair process. But the pain will be felt nonetheless. I think the parallel, probably the better parallel than either Canada or the UK in the 1990s, is actually what happened in the UK in the 1980s, where we had very restrictive fiscal and monetary policies for quite a substantial period of time, which resulted in the fact that we got growth, but growth which was too slow to bring down unemployment. And as if you remember, the economy started to recover in 1981, after the 80s recession, but unemployment didn't peak until 1986 still remained high for some time after that. I think the underlying labour market works a lot better now, so one might be a bit more optimistic about that, but I think the general conditions of overall demand in the economy are pretty much similar to that situation, which is why CIPD is currently expecting that the combination of deficit reduction, public sector job losses, and a constrained demand in the overall economy will cause a relapse in the labour market, which this year has stabilised. It will cause a relapse which will continue into next year. Unemployment will rise probably into the middle or end of 2012, peaking at somewhere just below 3 million, and in all probability stay at that level for certainly the first the remainder of the first half of this decade. In that context, people's real living standards are going to be, on average, probably growing by nothing at all. And in the public sector, where there's going to be marked nominal pay restraint, there's probably going to be substantial real income reductions. And so that's going to cause a lot of pain. This fits into the broader picture of the Queen's speech, because the deficit reduction looms over everything, both in the speech and in the coalition programme for government. And many of what you might call the nicer, softer, cuddly stuff in there is going to largely be swamped by a lot of shit, basically, as people feel the hardship that's upon them. How we manage that as a society, I think, is going to be critical. Tony says that the government doesn't have a mandate for this. I'm not entirely sure, because I think the essentially what we're going to get is broadly conservative economic policy. And I think, you know, that there was probably just about an understanding of what that entailed. I think what will be interesting is, this issue of social unrest. I'm concerned about the union response. I mean, I've said elsewhere that I think there is a good chance that some point before 2016, which would bring us up to the 90th anniversary of the 1926 general strike, we will see another kind of general strike. How serious that is difficult to judge. Tony mentions examples such as Ireland and Spain. Latvia, I must confess, I don't know a great deal about Latvia. But what's interesting is one of the reasons why Ireland has been relatively successful at containing worker and general social unrest as it's been trying to cut back on the public sector is that it's had quite a long tradition over several decades of social partnership, collective agreements, government, unions, employers, organisations working together in various ways. We did away with that tradition in the 1970s, whether rightly or wrongly is another matter for debate, but we don't have that kind of social dialogue infrastructure here. And in the absence of that, I think, you know, kind of talk about consultation, whether it's a PR exercise or not, as Nigel Lawson says, will be, sort of very significant. And I hope that, possibly the one advantage of having a coalition is that, we might be able to build a greater consensus about this. Being an economist, I'm naturally a pessimist, rather like Victor Meldrew, who I mentioned at the start, and I'm sort of slightly worried that, you know, things are going to get a bit hairy, certainly for a while, as we go through this age of austerity. The notion of progressive cuts probably won't cut a great deal of ice. And when you're talking about pain for a purpose, people are going to wonder, who's suffering the pain and what is the purpose? And that's a big question that's going to be asked in the next few years, I think. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Great, John. Thanks very much. How honest do you think politicians have been, either before the election or since? Or is it the fact that maybe they still don't really know the scale of the problem?
Before the election, if you remember, it depends what you mean by honesty. I mean, there was a period, back in the autumn down to the winter, you had Clegg talking about savage cuts in the public sector. Osborne started to coin the phrase age of austerity. Both their support waned at that time. So it's not surprising that they changed their rhetoric. I think they do anticipate the scale of the challenge. I think the issue is not so much the scale; it's about how they can entwine with that scale issue their broader, strategic, ideological sort of strategy, if you like, because that they are. And I think this applies to the Liberal Democrats as well as the Conservatives, that they are now moving in a sort of small state direction. which has pretty fundamental, Tony's already alluded to this, pretty fundamental consequences for the way that that we organise ourselves as a society. And putting that agenda alongside the deficit agenda, that's where the big political issue comes. And I think it's really the case that they haven't up to now spelt out entirely the consequences of that. What we've seen, particularly this week, is a gradual softening up of it. And I think there is as well an emerging, it seems to be the intellectual consensus at the moment seems to be buying into that agenda as well. So, we're seeing a sort of a momentum building, and the key is, at what stage do people actually start, feeling the direct consequences of that on the ground?
And Tony, you mentioned the creation of the Office of Budget Responsibility. How important is that going to be, and is it something that George Osborne might live to regret in the future?
Well, he won't regret it for a bit. He might even regret it in the short term, because if it starts to, say things like growth is going to be less than the previous government suggested, and it might also say, well, then that's a whole load of liabilities on the public sector's books here, which the previous government, to varying degrees, didn't recognise. That, of course, if it's put in a particular, it depends how they write it, for and of itself could spook the markets, which would create even greater problems for the government. So the way they present what they find just before, and this is going to be quite soon, I think is very important. Mm. So in a square bracket, if I were in the Treasury, I'm not sure I would be over the moon with the Office of Budget Responsibility, which sort of implies that the Treasury can't be trusted to do this kind of thing. And the Treasury, I think, has had a number of hits to its self in the last few weeks since the election, because they've had to publish documents effectively saying, well, we got it wrong. And it may have been politically that it was wrong, but that tells us that there's politics tangled up in what we thought were independent forecasts. Yeah. So I think there's a kind of complicated issue there. But coming back to your first question to John, I do think that whatever the legitimacy of the government as it approaches what they're about to do, we do have a wider question in Britain, which embraces all the parties that have, both the ones that have been, all three that have now been in government latterly. And that is that there is an unwillingness to accept that you can't sustain a public sector, a welfare state, the size that we have, with taxes that never rise or taxes and government receipts that won't rise above 36, 37, 38% of GDP. And no politician will make the case for higher taxes, not higher visible taxes. There's a perfectly good moral case to be made for higher taxes, but people won't make it. Very few politicians will make it. And therefore, they talk about, if you look at all the time that's spent looking at public finances, about 99% is about how much we're spending, and 1% about what the tax burden is and what taxes actually, or how taxes impact. And I think that that is a prolonged difficulty, because over recent years, public expenditure has averaged 42% of GDP, whereas government receipts have averaged 38% of GDP. And that cannot be sustained forever. And the adjustment will either have to be made by a once-and-for-all increase in our taxes or a once-and-for-all reduction in the size of the state. And because politicians cannot bring themselves to argue for higher taxes, they're going to take almost all of this change on the size of the state. And I'm particularly interested why politicians on the left are so unwilling. It'd be interesting to see how the Labour leadership campaign pans out, because even on the left, politicians are very, very unwilling to make the case for higher direct taxation.
Now, apparently, I'm told we've got about 2,000 people watching live online. If any of them would like to feed in questions via Twitter, they could do so on the hashtag QS2010. let's bring the audience in. Anybody like to take up any of the points that have been raised by Tony and John so far? If you'd like to raise your hand, or are we going to have complete and utter silence? Right, it's a gentleman at the back there. If you can just wait for the microphone. I assume, and if you can just say who you are.
Hello. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for that most fascinating introduction. Could I ask a question about what is likely to happen in public sector labour markets? I'm Robert Black. I'm the Auditor General for Scotland. If we take the Irish situation, they moved very quickly to introduce cash cuts in public sector salaries, which were quite severe. The first part of my question is the extent to which the panel thinks that that is a likelihood in the UK situation, or the extent to which you believe that the government might rely on inflation to reduce real wages. And the second part was really, I was very interested in John Fulmet's point about whether or not any of the tactics adopted by the private sector during the recession, such as shorter working weeks and so on for a temporary period in order to sustain the labour force. If I heard you correctly, I think you were saying you thought that was unlikely to be a possibility in the public sector. I wonder if you could expand upon that point, because it does seem to me that there are issues in there that we really need to think quite carefully about and think about what messages we are sending out regarding the future nature of what you might call conventional public sector employment.
I'll just respond to both of those. I mean, it's been interesting that so far there's been no... Can you hear me? Well, perhaps I should stand. Would that help? Or? Oh, OK. It's been surprising in a way that there's been no mention of nominal pay reductions in the public sector, given that that seems to be quite popular in all of the other big example countries where this has been going on. A lot of people have been asking me this question of late, and my answer is that it wouldn't surprise me if we see it at some stage, possibly even mentioned in the emergency budget, but my guess would be that rather than being applied across the entire public sector, it would be applied just to, what might be called the big wigs of various kinds, which may or may not be what's required, but it would fit in with this notion that you can somehow have, you know, kind of progressive reductions. And in a sense, it appeals to me more, I think your salary might well be one of those that would be cut in those circumstances. But, on balance, I'd probably prefer to see you take a pay cut than, somebody at the bottom end. But that's just a sort of personal gripe on...
You're really glad you asked the question now.
Yeah, on
I'm not in the league table.
Ah, right, okay. I mean, on the...
More sensible in Scotland, though. Yeah.
I mean, on this point about, it's possible that I'm being sort of too negative about this, but I just see a difference between a situation in the private sector in the recession where employers knew that in all likelihood they would require some employees once the economic conditions had improved, and it was better to put them on shorter time or reduce their pay to get a temporary reduction in wage costs rather than release them and then have to go through the entire rigmarole of hiring them again. That was the reason for doing it, and workers, whether voluntarily or, you know, because they had no real choice, preferred that to losing their jobs. The fundamental difference is that even in the private sector, employers don't do that if they're undergoing fundamental structural change, and they're prepared to make people redundant if they think that they're not going to actually need them over a longer period of time. And I think that's more analogous to what we're seeing in the public sector at the moment. We're going to go through a period of profound structural change, and simply cutting the pay of people that you don't need is not the appropriate response. I think what will happen is that there will be considerable pay restraint, whether because inflation feeds into nominal wage freezes or small rises, or because of cuts in nominal pay. But they will happen alongside cuts in employment, not be used as an alternative to those cuts?
I mean, clearly, I mean, there'll be a lot of, I think, the government's going to push pay bill decisions downwards. They'll want to hold the pay bill or even cut the pay bill and then allow managers locally, or at least not at the centre, to decide the trade-off between the numbers of people employed and the amount they get paid. And clearly, the further that decision can be pushed down, the easier it makes it for government at some level, but the greater, the more caricatured is the decision at the local level about do we keep people and pay them less, or have fewer people and have pay rises. And I can see the logic from government's point of view of pushing those decisions as far away from Whitehall as they can get them. You ask a very interesting question, Bob, on the question of periods not working. I think I'm right in America. Anybody knows America here? It may not only be America. They have, I've never known how to pronounce this word. Is it furlough or furloughs? These are effectively times when you, as a public sector worker, and it happens in big cities that are short of money, you just get days off unpaid. Services just stop for a day. Now, I'm not advocating that myself, but it is an interesting... We know how British policymakers love things American. That is done in the United States. Effectively, periods when public sector workers don't work, but they don't get paid. And there is there the same trade-off between keeping the job and being paid less. And that is what it's going to come down to.
Right, another question. Down the front here, lady here. Just here? I don't know who's got the microphones.
My voice cans.
Not online, it doesn't.
Poser Sander, Fine Art Trade Guild. I have a question, I think particularly for John Philpott, which is whether what studies have been done about the cost of redundancy for 750,000 people. I would have thought that was very substantial in the short term, and I thought it was in the short term that we're trying to make the savings.
Yeah, I mean, obviously... In the presentation, I didn't want to go into too much detail, but you know, when you're talking about 725,000 job losses, you're not necessarily talking about that number of redundancies. And ideally, you will limit the number of certainly compulsory redundancies in that total, and ideally, you know, get down the number of voluntary redundancies. I think given the scale of the issue, we can't avoid that, but there will be a preference in the short run for recruitment freezes and things of that kind. You raise an interesting question, though, because we did, right at the start of the recession, a study looking at the cost of redundancy, and it's staggeringly high in the public sector. You know, paying off public sector workers is a considerable cost, and I'm not entirely sure what allowance is made for that in the going forward spending review. It will have to be taken account of. I mean, there were prior to the election efforts to reduce the quality of redundancy payments. You may remember there was, you know, sort of talk of a possible dispute with the public service unions about this, but that, as far as I remember, that is still going through. And an economy, sort of saving approach might be to actually sort of just try and become much more tougher on redundancy terms, but that will piss the unions off as much as talking about wage cuts and pension reduction. So it may be a way out of the dilemma financially, but again raises a variety of political challenges, I think.
I think my question is really that those things take time. If you're going to look at the policy for redundancy and the terms, then that's going to take even longer.
So can you use the microphone?
Yeah, and CIPD, I mean, we're kind of stuffed full of HR people whose primary interest is all of this stuff. And, you know, when I make my blithe comments as an economist, they raise these things and say, aha, it's actually going to be a lot more difficult than that. I think there are a whole host of practical issues because you probably tell from my comments I'm not a particular opponent of the public sector, but I have my sort of criticisms of large swathes of it, and one of them is just how kind of bureaucratic, unwieldy, overburdened with cost the whole HR provision is in that sector, and that is something that needs to be reformed as part of this this overall structural reform process, I think.
Right, let's have another question. Gentleman there.
My name is John Beatry. I'm from Brent. Can you hear me?
Is that microphone working? Because... Is it working?
It's grey, it's Q.
Let's have another one.
My name is John Beatry. I'm from Brenton. It still doesn't work as far as I can see. But anyway.
That's better.
That's better, yeah.
Just hold it right up to your mouth.
My question is basically around the issue. We heard about localization during the election campaign and doing away with targets and allowing local authorities to make decisions. Is this the way that some of the pain is going to be delegated down, where a local authority will be told that they have to cut their budget by a certain sum, and they'll be able to decide whether they cut their capital program, whether they cut their staff, or whether they make cuts in the services, and thereby the government sidestepping some of the national, disharmony or anti-union movements that we're likely to see?
Tony.
I mean, government can't, in the normal run-of-the-mill run of things, tell local authorities what to spend. They can cap their council tax, and indeed they have, in effect, previous government capped council tax. And they could also, of course, the government could cut the grants that councils receive. Councils do have, as you will know, income from other sources. They've got the council tax, they have income from fees and charges, which could go up. I mean, things like council house rents, although they're separately accounted for, I think you'd have to expect those to start going up in above normal what's happened in recent years. But I think that going back to Dear Canada, and the idea that I think the Treasury has is of trying to transfer much more than just local governments spending downwards in an attempt to get a local decision-making process that allows what the previous government called, for those of you who are in local government, the total place initiative, to work effectively. That is to allow, at the local level, decisions about not just local government services, but the health service, police, even welfare benefits, an extreme version, that would be very extreme, to be made at the local level so as to allow efficiencies and removals of overlap. But you only have to say that to see it is an incredibly radical idea. And it could produce the efficiencies, I think, that government wants, but it would require central government, and I referred to this earlier on, to be very much more willing to shift power downwards and then, therefore, to accept the opening up of the dreaded postcode lottery. That is, there would be differences in approach. And, we come up against the very heavily evolved worry in the core of British government, regardless of which party's in power, about differences appearing between what's provided in one place as compared with another. And so I think that this is going to be a big challenge for the government. I think the Treasury, which is always more pro-devolution than we think, because they think local decision-making can be more efficient and can get spending cuts made quicker, the Treasury is going to have to fight this out with the spending departments, because you can be absolutely sure the robber barons in the other departments won't want to lose control of anything that's in their budget.
Do you think that that local authorities could then try and transfer these difficult decisions onto local people and hold one or two of these referendums? OK, well, we've been told we've got to cut X million pounds. You decide how we're going to do it.
It might be possible to do that, and because no doubt that insofar as the idea of talking with 60 million people about what they'd like to keep and what they're prepared to sacrifice It's just impossible. It's not impossible if you do it at the local level and, in a sense, create the conditions locally or below the local authority level where people have to trade off at the in the public sector in exactly the same way they do in their own lives. Everybody's used to making trade-offs in their own life, you know, between a big new white goods or going on holiday. But in the public sector, those decisions are made by other people, therefore everybody can ask for the things they want. So clearly, the more you can push those decisions locally, then the trade-offs will occur locally, and people, of course, are sensible. They will understand that difference. But again, to get there would require such a radical decentralisation in the British political psyche that, it, in a sense, we end up doing two things at once, you know, which is, one, making the spending reductions, and two, allowing decisions to be made in neighbourhood or local levels, which we've absolutely avoided allowing that level of discretion for decades.
Wasn't that one of the key things in the Canadian example, where the government actually took the people with them and they bought into the cuts that had to be made?
Absolutely. But, I mean, we know, but the fact is that the UK is not just... It isn't just the fact that the UK has the most centralised public finance arrangements in the developed world, certainly of any big country, but British national governments have a mistrust of the local. So they've got to get over those two. 95% of all taxes paid in Britain are paid to central government. That means that if anything local is to make decisions about efficiencies, somehow that money's got to get to them.
A conclusion from that would be that this is not going to happen unless there is the political will to drive it through the civil service machinery.
Absolutely. And the civil service machinery, and indeed ministers, again, of any government, once they're in power, you know, suddenly they're confronted with a room full of levers to pull. And all those years of getting up there to the cabinet position or permanent secretary... The idea of then you just give away power, you know, you only have to say it to know it doesn't make sense. And they are, Whitehall baronies are incredibly powerful, and we know incredibly adept at defending their money as they see it. So the big question is, can you imagine the Department for Health saying, yes, we'll allow our money to be pooled with local government money so that at the local level, big efficiency savings can be made? And if you can get that through the Department of Health, you're all right.
Well, I'm sure Eric Pickles will talk about that later. All right, final question in this session. A gentleman there.
Yes, George McGregor, Politics International. What are the panel's views on the chances of the UK re-entering recession as a result of these cuts? You know, if we're going to take out £40 to £50 billion out of the public sector and make 725,000 people lose their jobs, you know, the private sector is very healthy in this country, but can it really pick up the slack of such reductions in the public sector? And if we do re-enter recession, aren't we entering a kind of vicious circle that, you know, if we're going to make these cuts, consumer confidence is going to plummet when they see job losses and cuts in their pay and pensions and whatever, which in return is going to kind of reduce consumer spending, and, you know, we're going to get less tax receipts for the government, which means we're going to need to make even more cuts in order to kind of fix the structural deficit.
Always nice to finish on a positive note. John?
I mean, I think there's an outside risk of that. I mean, it's what Danny Blanchflower has described as the death spiral, and he's been quite critical of government on that, or the new government on that basis. I'm a bit more optimistic than that, but my feeling is that what we're actually going to see is not a double-dip recession, but prolonged, very slow growth, which will mean that the private sector isn't able to offset public sector job losses. We'll see, therefore, unemployment being somewhat higher than would otherwise have been the case, and more prolonged. I mean, clearly, you know, the issue, I mean, this isn't fundamentally, in a way, a political point, because, you know, the deficit has to be dealt with, and the real difficulty that we've had is that the recession was so deep, and the recovery has you know, essentially relied on government stimulus of one kind or another, And you know, the return to growth has been slow. That's been the real problem. It all of this is still, you know, symptomatic of the global recession that we were initially hit by.
I too think you know, the 3.5% growth per year figures are pretty unlikely. Always did and said so, and I think John's spot on. I think that you know, we must always avoid, and my goodness, we've done it this morning, of sort of assuming that when things are bad, they'll always stay bad. It's rather like when there's a boom going on. It's impossible to imagine the boom ever ending. Well, you know, the slump won't go on forever. They never do. But I think there's a real chance, given the need to slim down the deficit. Whether that's done by public spending cuts or tax increases, both suck money out of the economy. So it doesn't matter how it's done. I mean, the alternative would be not to do it. And I think that, you know, there is no question. We've seen from the problem of Spain and Greece and Portugal and the risks to their economies from the markets that there is only limited space for the British government to operate in. So I think that being seen to be serious about reducing the deficit, taking steps towards doing it should keep the markets happy, keep the government's fabled AAA rating. But then taking public money out of the economy probably will reduce growth to some extent. But again, probably not to the point of triggering a full-scale recession. I mean, I think that it just means a period of growth below the trend we were used to, and therefore probably higher unemployment than we've been used to. But that's John's world more than mine. You know, and by 2015, then it may revert to the long-term trend again. But there is an adjustment. And what we'll have effectively done, if that happens, is to reduce the scale of the deficit by shifting the burden to reducing the scale of growth for 5 years thereafter. So, in a sense, a bit more growth will have occurred 2007, 8, 8, 9, 9, 10, and a bit less growth 20, 10, 11, 11, 12, 13, and so on. I mean, it's just shifted some growth in order to soften, this Keynesian approach, you know, soften the recession.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It is 11 o'clock. We're going to finish this session here. I'd like to ask you to thank our speakers for their contribution to this session. Thank you so much, guys.